Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. We have almost reached the end of COP26 in Glasgow. After 2 weeks of discussion, world leaders who bothered to turn up have agreed some noble commitments to tackle climate change. There has been promising movement on ending deforestation and efforts to limit the use of methane and coal by some countries. We saw former US President Barack Obama apologise for Trump's climate scepticism, and Joe Biden unfortunately fall asleep on camera during speeches which kick-started the conference. President Biden may have been kipping, but eco-star Greta Thunberg was not, as she joined protesters in Glasgow to demand more action from politicians to tackle climate change. All in all, it's been an eventful 2 weeks with positive efforts to tackle CO2 emissions. But are efforts enough? And what does net zero mean for households now struggling with the cost of living? To get the full roundup and analysis of the conference, I'm delighted to be joined by Matthew Lesh, who is head of research at the Adam Smith Institute, and Andy Mayer, who is chief operating officer at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Welcome, both of you. Okay, first, what are your overall impressions of the conference? You know, has it had an historic impact on the future of the planet, or are the commitments announced just hot air? And I'll start with you, Matthew.
Look, I'm glad that after 2 weeks in Glasgow, climate change is solved. As Boris said, throughout the week, it went from 5-1 down at halftime, and then suddenly it was 2-5. And I think it's about time to declare its full time and victory. I mean, of course, like this is the whole expectations management game. We don't solve climate change at conferences in Glasgow. We solve it through actual practical actions with respect to decarbonization that requires huge investment and huge innovation. I'm sure we're going to get into some of the more specific issues at hand. The conferences probably have a place with respect to making commitments by governments, but that is basically all that they really are. That's all that's in the Paris Agreement. All they're talking about here is a bunch of side commitments. So there are a few interesting commitments in relation to methane, in relation to deforestation, although not signed up to by many countries, related to cars. You've got also financial commitments from big financial institutions. So there's a lot of commitments, a lot of talk. What actually matters, though, is what happens kind of between these conferences and what happens practically on the ground. A good example of this might be something like solar and wind energy, which, although causing grid instability issues, has massively come down in price. That had nothing to do with anything that really happened at a COP. That was just due to the fact that you had big investment and big innovation that brought down the price. And that's going to be the kind of change which addresses an issue like climate change.
Andy, you know, was it all hot air? Was there anything that was important that's come out so far?
Well, I'm glad Matt gave that very compelling overview. And unfortunately, unlike the ASI, the IEA did not have a private jet or indeed a yacht in order to get to Glasgow.
I'll have you know that I went commercial, actually.
That's great to hear, Matt. And thank you for doing your bit for the environment. I went one better by not going.
You're the true environmental hero.
Well, in not going, I feel that I saw the conference very much in the same way that the general public saw it, or rather largely ignored it. If we look at a poll from earlier this year by Yonder, they asked 2,000 British people what they thought of COP26. And you want to hazard a guess how many had heard of it?
I wouldn't know. Not very many.
Within the margin of error.
Well, no, that's not strictly fair. About 86% of people claim to know little to nothing about it, and 60% of those knew nothing at all. And this is at the start of the hype about COP. Now, I'm sure that would have gone up, but mostly COP is about what politicians, what large businesses, and what activists and NGOs want to say about climate change. So it's a very strange event, and it's very much more like a party political conference. Mm. Than it is like a meeting of an international body designed to change the world.
I think one of the main things that stuck out for me, and possibly the general public if they actually do know this, is that none of these commitments are binding. So there's no stick to force these countries to do any of the commitments that we signed up to. Matt, you were on the ground during COP26 in Glasgow. What was your feel of the mood around the conference?
Yeah, so for full disclosure, I was at a side conference, a climate and freedom conference, and a few kind of market orientated efforts to talk about more, I suppose, sane approaches to fighting climate change. But just like Greta Thunberg, I was on the fringes. I wasn't invited to speak, nor was I invited to attend the proper COP conference. I did have a walk around, and there were the various protests going on, and the delegates from all over the joint. I did find this quite fascinating thing where you could probably live in Glasgow and barely even realize COP was going on. Just it's a particular event space which is kind of just outside the center of town. Most people just continue on with their day-to-day activities, not really thinking too much about it. I mean, the conversations I was having probably weren't the same with conversations that were going on inside the conference venue. I think from where the conferences I was attending, people I was speaking to, there was a lot of optimism about tackling climate change, about the ability to use market-based solutions to do so, and the importance of things like property rights, the importance of things like removing regulatory barriers, of facilitating investment, of clean free trade, all these kind of more positive approaches that don't require adjusting the entire economic system to fight this issue. In fact, can do it probably more effectively without adjusting the entire economic system. But I don't think that's necessarily the mood that I heard when I went past protesters outside the conference, nor much of the mood inside of it itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect point. I think the protest, a lot of it was, you know, saying that the politicians are simply not doing enough. Andy, you were quoted in CityAM while discussing Greta Thunberg, and you, I mean, goes perfectly onto my next question. You know, Russia and China failed to turn up to COP26. These two countries are major polluters, with China producing the most CO2 emissions in the world. You know, inevitably people will ask, you know, why are we, that a nation that produces, I think, 1.1% of global emissions, bearing the costs of this global struggle?
Well, that's a great question, and I think, you know, Greta, to give her credit, is probably one of the most quotable people on this issue. I mean, she's largely going to be remembered in this one for saying two things. The first of which I assume was ironic, was she was singing a song that went something along the lines of, "You can stick your climate crisis up your," I can't say it on a family broadcast. And secondly, for just saying it's all just blah, blah, blah. So I don't think Greta's changed her views, but those are both comments that could be made by people who are extremely skeptical that this work is valuable, which, to be clear, it does not include us. We don't think this is a particularly edifying spectacle to see all these high-flying elites come together to talk to each other. But also, clearly, quite a lot does go on the side, on the fringe, where Matt was, which enables people to do some really useful work and make some really useful connections. And that stuff, and the stuff, as Matt noted earlier, between the conferences, is what's going to really work. Going to your second point about China, Russia, and the cost of bearing the cost of climate change. I mean, built in right from the start of the process, and this process is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, going all the way back to around about 1995, not 1992, which was when the Rio Declaration established the UNFCCC. It was taken as read that the burden of responsibility would fall on the developing world, what was called Annex One and Annex Two countries, which are the countries that the UN agreed were the ones who most benefited from industrialization and should therefore bear the cost so it doesn't impede on sustainable development in the rest of the world. But it's not very clear why that doesn't include at least China and to some extent Russia in the same boat.
Mm.
And China in particular has grown enormously since 1992 and quite clearly is the world's largest emitter of CO2 and possibly some of the other greenhouse gases as well. So why it is that we seem to think it is our job to pay for everything, or is pay a vastly greater proportion of the costs than anyone else, is a mystery. And just to be clear what that means, if we just look at the International Climate Fund, this is the thing that was set up back under the Climate Change Act, then implemented by the coalition. That started off at about 3 to 4 billion every year. It was increased to 6 billion a year after Paris. As part of the Glasgow preamble, Boris wants to increase it to £12 billion a year. Now that's as a share of the 100 billion that all parties have committed to help the developing world. So this would leave the UK providing 12% of the finance, having been responsible for 1% of the emissions. And this makes no sense whatsoever.
Like you say, Andy, this is an historic commitment. Matthew, the UK has pledged 290 million at COP26. You know, what are your thoughts on this? Do we have an obligation as the founder of the Industrial Revolution to, you know, pay almost reparations in a way for climate change?
Look, I think this in a sense speaks to the central issue when it comes to climate change, which is climate change is not some evil cooked up by oil companies in order to destroy the world and some malevolent need. Climate change is a byproduct of development, of industrialization, of progress. And the challenge is, how can we address climate change, which is quite expensive, without putting undue burdens on to poor people in developed countries who don't necessarily, even if they support action on climate change, want to pay more on their energy bills, for example, or want to have to change around the gas boiler. But also at the same time, what do you say to developing countries that haven't had the opportunity that we've had to industrialize, that haven't had the same wealth and prosperity that really does come through that process, at least to begin with, is the environmental Kunitz curve. In the initial process of industrialization, emissions tend to go up. And I think it's very difficult to say to people that they should remain poor. Up in Glasgow, I heard a speech from a former president of the Maldives, Mohammed Nasheed, who made the point that you can't ask the poor to remain poor. You can't ask them to consume less energy. And he's a big supporter of market-based mechanisms to tackle climate change, because he understands that that's how you reach prosperity. It's interesting to see at the same time, you've got something like the like-minded developing countries group, which includes China and India, at one point during the conference asked for the entire section on mitigation to climate change to be removed because they don't want to reduce their emissions. And quite frankly, it's hard to blame them. It's hard to blame them for wanting to lift their people out of poverty and deal with the more immediate issues. Then on the other hand, you end up with a circular situation where they're like, well, developing countries give us money. I don't think it's completely unfair. The historical emissions certainly are caused by more developed countries, but the future emissions are certainly on track from the developing countries. So that it's a very hard issue and in some senses is really something that's not going to be solved with money, I don't think. I think it has to be solved with better technologies.
Matt, can I interrupt there? Because I'm not sure how fair it is, because what's missing from that equation, which sort of tries to paint this picture that the evil West industrialized first and did all this damage and therefore should clean up its own mess, misses the positive side of that equation, which is all the things that the evil West invented as a result of industrialization. So we can look at things like fertilizers and agrochemicals, which in large parts of the world have completely solved the problem of famine. Now, if we're going to have to pay compensation for climate change crimes, then surely we should be expecting to be discounted for the benefits we brought to the world by saving lives. We
can also I don't see it necessarily as compensation if you're paying money to developing countries to deal with climate change related issues. I think it's more of a forward-looking thing to say, how can we, you know, ensure that they use technologies that, for example, let's say nuclear for some countries to ensure that they have less carbon emissions. What are the technologies that can be enabled to decarbonize? But again, there's not enough money out there to make this happen. I mean, there was a comment from India's environment secretary saying they wanted $1 trillion in public funds by 2030 to reach climate goals. Now, they're not going to get given that kind of money. And I don't think there's a political appetite in developed countries to kind of hand that kind of money over en masse. And it sometimes feels at these conferences that what should really just be development aid people are asking for is now shrouded up in climate aid. So I think you're right. It's not that developed countries are guilty. It's that this is a problem. And if we have to pay something to help fix it, I think that's a good thing, even if, you know, it's obviously never going to be enough and the solutions ultimately are technological and market-based.
Andy, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we agree on that, Matt. I mean, I'd much rather that we were spending the international aid budget such as exists on capacity building. And that capacity building includes creating amazing technologies in countries where it is cheaper to deploy those technologies. That's a fantastic win-win for everybody, particularly on climate change, which is a global issue and fundamentally does not care where the greenhouse gas emissions are saved. So on that, we entirely agree. When it's countries like India moaning about needing money, though, oh, please. I mean, come on, this is a huge developing country with vast potential to have a sustainable economy of its own that's growing very fast and would be growing faster were it not so wedded to the terrible social democratic and socialist policies of its successive governments.
Look, I think that's completely right. Another area which we haven't quite talked about much is mitigation. So if you look over the last 100 years, the amount of climate-related deaths has declined by something like 99%. And that's largely because we've gotten richer and we're able to better deal with climate stress. Now, if we're going to accept, as we effectively do in these discussions, that there is going to be some climate change, be it 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, somewhere around that kind of area. If that does mean more extreme weather events, I think in some respects, the easy way to deal with that, rather than trying to, you know, fund decarbonization, could probably fund better protections for flooding in some developing countries, so that they can weather the storm that will be coming their way no matter what we do.
I think that's a great point. And when people start worrying about the cost of adaptation, I think we do need to remind people that the Netherlands defended itself from the ingress of the sea during its medieval period, when it was, in terms of GDP per head, which obviously can only be estimated, was far poorer than some of the developing countries today, who could well adapt much farther and faster than they did already, particularly if the West helps with a bit of sea capital, with a bit of international finance, with a bit of technology sharing.
I think that moves really well on to the next question that I have. And you know, we're talking about developing countries that don't have enough money, but one country that does is the US. You know, more than 40 countries have committed to move away from coal, but the world's biggest users like China and the US didn't sign up. The US, for all the sanctimonious talk on climate change, you know, they opted out on this major deal on coal. A lot of people think it's political considerations with the recent governor election result in Virginia, you know, coal states with interest in protecting the coal industry. How can we take global leaders seriously, especially when the United States can't commit to getting rid of the dirtiest energy source out there? And is it down to technological advancement, or is there deeper issues to why the US isn't moving on coal, Matthew?
Well, look, I think it is, everything is political again. Biden could sign up to a commitment to get rid of coal, but there's no chance that he could get that through Congress. And there's no chance that it could be enacted in practice in American states. So I think in the end, this is going to have to be a natural technological evolution. We've already seen a lot of that. The key reason why you've seen so much decarbonization in the US is not because of renewable energies, but it's because of reduction in use of coal and increased use of gas, particularly after the fracking revolution, which is unfortunately banned in the UK, but has been a huge windfall and has actually made the US an energy exporter. So I think it's about that kind of improvement. Where things haven't been so good, and this is one issue technologically that I'd like to see a lot more focus on, there was some discussion this week from Rolls-Royce about small modular nuclear reactors, SMRs. But you have the situation where you've seen a reduction in nuclear energy. In California, their final nuclear energy plant is about to shut down by 2025, and it's not clear how that's going to be replaced, and it's probably going to mean more coal and gas. And there's been campaigns often by environmentalists for many years against what is a cleaner technology. And as a result of that, it's much harder to decarbonize.
Andy, is it all about, you know, developing them technologies, allowing, you know, businesses and industry to adapt to new energy sources, or is this just, you know, how can we take global leaders seriously?
Okay, there's two separate questions there. One of them is really about interests. So all countries have interests. The United Nations is a collection of sovereign nations that are agreeing to pool their interests on various issues, but fundamentally they are answerable either to their electorates, or if you're an authoritarian regime, to the terrifying prospect of being replaced by another authoritarian regime, or in the enlightened future, something more democratic. So in every single case, we will see countries acting in their own interest, and the skill of the organisers of COP and other UN conventions is to try and get people to recognise that their pooled interests matter just as much as those individual interests. Where the US is concerned, that the Democrats are not bleeding heart environmentalists when it comes to the crunch is no surprise whatsoever. We need to remember that Clinton did not sign up to Kyoto. It was not until the Paris Agreement that was there any sign of the US getting involved in this stuff seriously. And even now, Biden's sort of doing his side deal with China and trying to do things in a way that's more friendly to the domestic audience than he is through the UN process. So despite the loss of Donald Trump as the president, not very much has actually changed. I mean, there's a lot more rhetoric and there's a lot more ambition from the Democrats for some of these environmental measures, but they're still answerable to those electorates in each of the states, and they still worry about losing those states, particularly after the, it's not a by-election, is it, that they've just had recently where they lost to the Republicans. So going back to your other point about technology, yeah, fundamentally, the answer to climate change is technology we do not yet have, deployed at a price that we cannot yet see, globally, in a timeline that we hope mitigates or stops the worst effects of anthropogenic climate change. And for those of us who are climate optimists, that's going to happen. We have every faith that the technologies will emerge incrementally and over time that enable that to happen. We're not catastrophists who believe that there's going to be runaway climate change that bores us all like a frog in a pan.
I mean, there's an interesting point on accountability there. Politicians are accountable to voters and vested interests and so forth. But I want to move on to something that's quite interesting. It's quite topical. Sleaze has been in the news this week. This month, the IEA released a paper scrutinising the climate change committee by our head of regulatory affairs, Victoria Hewson. The paper argues that the committee has expanded well beyond its statutory obligations and it acts in an overtly political way. It has failed to communicate and at times purposely suppress the cost of proposed climate policies. One of the most shocking parts of the paper is that it documents allegations of conflicts of interest amongst committee members, you know, showing that members benefited directly from the recommendations of the Climate Change Committee on topics such as electric vehicles. A question to both of you, is this a problem with climate corporatism? The idea that, you know, we're closing off relationships between government actors and corporates and sealing off competition and allowing rent seeking to happen on climate commitments. And Matt, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that first.
Yeah, look, climate change has become an industry to a large extent. There are a lot of businesses with interests in getting government subsidies that are campaigning to politicians, to ministers, to claim that their technology, that their innovation is the one to solve it. If only we could have another £1 million there or £1 million here. And that's become a central issue. Just to take one example, something like hydrogen. Hydrogen could potentially solve some issues when it comes to hard to decarbonize transport fuels. But right now we've seen a huge hydrogen push by fossil fuel energy companies. And they're interested in that because they think there could potentially be carbon capture and storage, and then they make hydrogen. In that whole process is not particularly green. It's not particularly sustainable, and it doesn't seem like a particularly fruitful way forward. Nevertheless, we'll hear a lot from ministers about the potential of hydrogen. So it does seem like there's that level of lobbying, that level of interest from businesses in this. And that's why in my kind of central approach to climate change, I'm very against regulatory changes, very against subsidies, unless in either case, they're absolutely proven to be necessary and beneficial, and much more in favor of technologically neutral approaches. Things like prizes, I think, are a good approach. Things like carbon taxes are a good approach, just to encourage people to innovate, to make changes away from carbon intensive processes and instead find their own way forward with respect to how to decarbonize, rather than the government picking certain winners and losers.
Andy, I mean, would you agree with that? Is the process of sort of climate corporatism actually slowing down the, you know, progression to new technologies and innovative ways to get emissions down?
Yeah, and Matt's spot on in his analysis there. I mean, this is the low carbon industrial complex. This is the unhealthy collusion of politicians and governments with corporations and other interest groups, with the public being excluded but expected to pay the bills. Now, the climate we're in at the moment, there is a growing concern about sleaze and corruption at a fairly minor level in government, but mostly related to the way that politicians are trying to use their time outside parliament and then perhaps use their parliamentary time to act on behalf of business interests. Well, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, we already know from Victoria's paper that there's an unhealthy level of business interest for those sitting on the main regulated task with regulating climate change. And that's a disgrace. I mean, it was a mistake in the first place to set up the CCC, the Committee on Climate Change, as both a regulator of the carbon budgets, which is a dry technical job, and also a lobbyist designed to encourage the government to meet its own climate commitments. So this is straightforward sock puppetry. That's bound to lead to conflicts of interest and should never have happened. Well, politicians, bless them, are rational actors. If they can see all this going on, all this public money swilling around, they think they can help by getting business interests into their seats to deliver climate change solutions. Of course, they're going to do that. There's an ethical way of doing that, which is saying somebody's come from a very interesting idea. I'm very happy to go on TV and say this is a fantastic idea. And there's an unethical way of doing that, which is taking money from that company to do the same thing. So politicians should not be lobbyists. They should only be acting in the public interest, and they should be doing so without the need to be rewarded for doing so, other than the joy of being a democratically elected politician.
The IA Director General, Mark Liswood, argued in the Times last week that a politically motivated focus on targets rather than outcomes would lead to failure. Instead, there is an alternative, right? You know, market-led strategy to tackle climate change, which would focus on outcomes as opposed to politically motivated targets. You know, is that a fair assessment, Matt? Are we in trouble of setting targets and dates and not actually meeting and making meaningful change? And should there be an alternative way of actually viewing how we get to how we tackle climate change?
So I think one of the central issues of climate change policy has been a real vacancy in recent decades by advocates of markets. And that's because, I think rightfully so, in many cases, we've seen a lot of climate advocacy as a really shrewd attempt at having a more top-down economy of higher regulations and more control. And, you know, just look at George Monbiot and his recent article about how climate change is caused by capitalism, total nonsense. Of course, because, you know, non-capitalist systems also industrialize and also have consequences of climate change. And I think what we're now seeing, though, is a renewed effort by people on, I suppose, the side of markets and free economies to make an argument that we actually do have the solutions here. And while I was up in Glasgow, I was at a conference where we the official release of the International Declaration on Market Environmentalism that's been signed by over 130 people across 60 countries and talks about things like, you know, using a market economy to ensure efficient use of resources, having private property rights to make sure that we treat our what we own well, and things like decentralization, optimism and innovation, a kind of different approach to tackling market issues that's less focused on the kind of grandstanding we hear a lot from governments, less focused on I'm going to do X, I'm going to do Y, and basically saying, yes, this is a problem, but it's a problem that market actors are very capable of solving. In fact, potentially the only way to really solve these issues is by focusing on the ability of people to innovate and invest in order to address this problem. That's the kind of optimistic approach here. The only other alternative, which will never be politically palatable in any country really, is basically returning to pre-industrial times and switching off our economies entirely and losing, you know, everything that makes modern life worth living. And with that not likely to happen, we're going to need a market approach, and we're going to need to be able to maintain our living standards whilst addressing this issue.
Just before I let you respond, Andy, and have, you know, say your thoughts, Mark's article, you know, talked about the price mechanism, you know, Ronald Coase's theorem on property rights to address negative externalities. You were speaking about, you know, the need to get rid of regulatory barriers, which impedes like low carbon alternatives such as carbon pricing. And, you know, the idea that, you know, prosperity isn't an evil, and, you know, that there is a fallacy that the perpetual economic growth leads to more pollution. There's an interesting blog on the IA website which argues against that. In fact, you peak at a certain level, and in fact, you start losing less emissions as you're more developed. Andy, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, if we get to the central point, how helpful are the targets? Because everything about these COPs is obsessed with whether or not we're going to achieve a two degrees level of warming based on a non-Pacific start date, which is basically defined as pre-industrial levels. And whether after Paris it could actually be got down to 1.5. So there's been some twittering and speculation about whether or not the agreements amount to somewhere between 1.8 degrees warming all the way up to, I think, 2.4, 2.7 was the more pessimistic analysis from one of the other groups during the conference. And frankly, who cares? We don't know. This is too far in the future. What the various bodies behind the UN FCCC do is produce these scenarios, and they are scenarios, which produce a broad range of different climate outcomes that are possible, but we don't have the scientific knowledge to know which of them is actually going to be more likely. So all we can do is focus on mitigation and adaptation technologies that might succeed in helping us out, whether we are looking at 3 degrees warming, 5 degrees warming, or 1 degrees warming. And to do that, Mark is totally correct, you need a good global carbon price. So what the COP could be doing is getting countries to agree to set a level of a carbon price, which would then stop climate change distorting international trade, which is essential for the deployment and spread of low carbon technologies. And if it's not done right, means that you end up in the situation the UK is in, where we've essentially offshored most of our emissions through heavy industry. So this is something that people could be doing, which is a lot simpler, but it's a lot less jazzy. It's much more fun to be able to put on a high-vis jacket and go and have your photograph taken with a large wind turbine, or open a new factory, or claim that you're doing good by spending other people's money on international aid.
I accidentally run into Nicola Sturgeon, who's standing around.
Well, she must be having a very lonely time at the moment. But this isn't really the meat of it for the climate bureaucrats. What they want is an ever more rigorous climate target, ever more claims that it's legally binding. And some of these politicians are competing with one another to move the date forward or backwards to show their commitment to various interest groups and to reduce the level of temperature that they are claiming they will achieve, which they will not. They have no influence over that whatsoever. We don't even know what technology it is that will actually help solve this problem yet.
I mean, the consensus behind net zero could fracture if decarbonisation is perceived as unfair, or if it raises costs for consumers excessively. I mean, there has been talk of a referendum on net zero, and it is growing. Matt, do you think the public will demand a lot more accountability? And do you think, you know, that as the cost of living climbs, that net zero should be under a lot more scrutiny than it currently is?
Yeah, I think that the polling on net zero or on climate change in general is quite fascinating, because if you ask people in the broad, do you think we should do more to tackle climate change, they'll all say yes. If you say we'll do it without costing you anything, they'll say yes even more. But once you start actually saying this is going to cost you, you know, £10, £20, £30 more a month, you suddenly start seeing that support really dives off a cliff. People in the abstract want this tackled, but in the practical terms, they don't. I think this is the real challenge with addressing climate change. We're just seeing this at the moment. You know, it's kind of ironic that we're talking about climate change goals in the middle of a global energy crisis to some extent, and rising electricity prices in the UK that are very much linked to the increased use of renewables in the energy grid, without actually having a sustainable backup when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. Again, this is talking about what Andy was on about earlier, that we don't have the technology yet when it comes to batteries to really make for a sustainable energy grid with renewables. So it just means increasing kind of costs to consumers as a result. And will there be a political revolt against this? I think we more likely than not, you will. And this is, we've really seen this to some extent, the Gilets Jaunes in France, the refusal of kind of more working class people to pay additional taxes in order to tackle climate change seems like a good marking point. I was in this fascinating conversation once where this is at a conference for students, and the person sitting next to me, quite senior kind of person, made the point, well, you know, we shouldn't use taxes to tackle climate change. What we should instead is use regulations, because that doesn't cost anyone anything. And I just I shook my head in absolute horror, thinking, do you not realize regulations also have costs? They're often governments like regulations, they secretly pass on the costs. And the reason why they're not really willing to do carbon taxes is because the costs are quite explicit. Now, I think the way you solve this problem, in my mind at least, is yes, use a carbon tax, but then you compensate people, put money back into people's pockets from the carbon tax. Don't use it to raise revenue. Don't use it to spend on politicians' favorite things. Just use it for an economic efficiency purpose and reduce other taxes and reduce other costs of people on the way. I think that's the only way to square this. But all we're going to get in the meantime are increasing costs because of regulation, because of the money that's had to be spent on subsidies, without actually a dividend to people like you could have if you just taxed and lowered other taxes in the process.
Andy, referendum on net zero?
Oh, we love referendums. I think the difficulty with the referendum on net zero is, what is the question and what does it mean if people said they didn't want it? We saw with the Brexit referendum that the government put no thought whatsoever into the answer that it didn't want, and we ended up with a five-year mess following the referendum as to what Brexit really meant, which has ended up with very few people being happy, and they're still talking about it, and it's still being unbundled, particularly in the context of Northern Ireland. If let's imagine that a very successful campaign was run in order to say no to net zero, well, what is the alternative that then would have won that referendum? Would it be a complete ignoring of climate change as an issue? Would it be a minimalist approach? Would it be a sort of free market environmentalist approach, as we might like? Would it be a highly interventionist one that just happened to focus on something else? So not sure what that really means. You'd have to end up with a multi-choice referendum, at which point you get various people saying, well, we don't need to do this. We need to do citizens' juries instead. The deliberative process, I think, is the Extinction Rebellion position.
It's almost like we already have a process for people to make decisions on our behalf, and we should perhaps use that process.
Oh, democracy, yes. Funny. Yes. I mean, the other point you were making, I think, was around the rebellion. Now, are we going to see people rise up against the enormous costs that some of these policies would impose? Well, yes. I mean, we've been here before, at least twice, probably more often. So firstly, let's look at fuel duty. It's not risen since 2011. And the reason it's not risen since 2011 is because of the fuel protests. Politicians have wisely decided that it is not worth the political capital trying to force up the price of petrol to a ludicrously high carbon price, given the reaction from people who depend on petrol for their livelihood. We've been here again with David Cameron. David Cameron started his political journey with a very famous photograph of hugging a husky, going out there and saying, look, this stuff really matters. And by the end of his tenure, he was saying, we don't want any more of this green crap. And he was driven utterly cynical by the enormous lobbying and potential problems that arose from the kind of the cost that could be imposed by some very bad green schemes. Boris, to everybody's surprise, having been the man who said that wind power couldn't blow the skin off a rice pudding, has turned that on its head and has started again from year zero, as though he is a naive young green activist who's just come out of college, having been lectured by nobody but people on the far left who could keep telling us that climate change is cost-free and in fact will create economic growth. Well, this is bonkers. He's going to reap the political whirlwind for that very quickly, particularly given the growing evidence of an energy crisis that's going to have an impact on people's home bills.
I'd like to add as well, I mean, I think this report came out today that, you know, Boris Johnson's levelling up agenda is going to have some serious problems when you consider that a lot of fossil fuel intensive industry is in northern areas and they're going to suffer with some job losses as a result of the policies.
Well, I lived that when I was working as the representative of a large chemical company. And part of that job was to close down energy intensive plant, because not because the people working there weren't doing a fantastic job, they were some of the most productive factories in the world. They just weren't relatively competitive compared to people doing the same thing in places like China or Indonesia. And the reason for that was that we were artificially increasing the cost of energy at home. Those factories simply cannot exist in the UK at the moment. And there's no real solution to that if your sole goal for energy policy is ever higher prices to encourage people to switch faster.
Just on a final piece of optimism here. I mean, I think it is worth acknowledging just the fact that we actually are reducing emissions while growing our economy. Just between 1990 and 2018, the UK economy, it grew by 74%, while at the same time, emissions fell by 19%. And that's in consumption terms, so even after accounting for outsourcing to the likes of China. It is possible to grow the economy, to get more efficient with resource use, to emit less over time. And that's something that we're going to achieve through technology, through innovation, and through massive investment, no whatever happens in Glasgow over the last few weeks.
And I agree with that, Matt. I just think that is just economic growth. I mean, economic growth is doing things more efficiently, and that includes resource efficiently. So you don't need to have an evangelical green agenda in order to get there. You simply need to have a ruthless focus on progress in the future, which includes a high degree of optimism that we can live in a cleaner, greener world, but it doesn't need all this sort of evangelical selling us in order to deliver it. It needs a proper environmentalist approach, which is saying, what can we do incrementally, step by step, to do these things we want to do better?
I think we've probably got some broad consensus on a lot of issues throughout the podcast, but unfortunately that is all we've got time for. So thank you to Matthew Lesh, who is head of research at the Adam Smith Institute, and to Andy Mayer, who is chief operating officer at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Thank you both, guys. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.